What's your family's version of Lime Jello Marshmallow Cottage Cheese Surprise? Did you ever sing a song about it? BGS is dying to hear about it. This holiday season, we want to read your food and music stories, writings, and traditions. Selected entries will be shared in our new BGS Creative Writing Collection. Send us your holiday food and music stories, snag some free BGS merch, and get published on the BGS website. Submissions will close at 50 entries. Details on how to submit at thebluegrasssituation.com/food and music. Hey, Basic Folk Buddies. I want to tell you about a podcast I really love called Broken Record. Each week, hosts Justin Richman and Leah Rose sit down for in-depth conversations with musicians from all kinds of genres and generations. You'll hear artists like Smokey Robinson, Billy Corgan, St. Vincent, Damon Albarn, Daryl Hall, and John Oates, and many more as they open up about their creative lives and the stories behind their most meaningful work. If you're a music fan, I highly recommend checking out Broken Record, where real musicians have real conversations. Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. I'm Cindy House. I am the host of this podcast. Thanks for listening today. Today we have the incredibly wonderful, talented, legendary Frazee Ford. Frazee has reissued her sophomore solo album, Indian Ocean. We talk all about that collaboration. Before we fully dive in, let's get into how you and I can stay in touch. Let's talk about what really matters. Have you signed up for our newsletter? It's a once-a-month email, comes into your inbox and lets you know who's been on the podcast recently and who's coming up. You can sign up for it at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. You can also find links to our social media in the show notes. We are at Basic Folk Pod, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. We're a listener-supported podcast. You can make a contribution and help pay for your Basic Folk listening at basicfolk.com/donate. And you know what? There is a link in the show notes to do so. Let's get down to it. Frazee Ford has always loved soul music. She fell in love with Otis Redding at age 11, discovered people like Ann Peebles along the way, but it was Al Green that really knocked her out. She loved the layers, the expression, and especially his voice. She completely dove in and even started an Al Green covers band. Although she'd been perfecting her soul sound, the band that took off for Ford was, of course, the Be Good Tanyas. She talks in our interview about how the trio really worked to perfect quiet, beautiful country music, which took roots in her love of soul. She took that love into her solo career with her first record, Obadiah. Even though her solo debut was mostly a folk record, documentary filmmaker Robert Gordon heard one of those songs on the radio. He sent her an email and invited her to work with Al Green's band, The High Rhythm Section. That invitation was the inception of her second album, 2014's Indian Ocean. Now with a deluxe edition release in 2025, Indian Ocean saw Frazee coming into her own as a solo artist, working with brothers Charles on the organ, Leroy on the bass, and Teeny on guitar. The Hodges brothers were the High Rhythm Section. They taught her so much about groove, space, and collaboration. In our conversation, Frazee revisits those sessions and the lessons they brought. She talks about how the brothers had always wanted to record with a folk artist and what kind of care and attention they brought to her songs. She reflects on her time working with Teeny Hodges, who actually passed away before Indian Ocean was released, but not before it was finished. We also get into her early life with her hippie family, her many creative outlets, and her fashion ethos. We'll take a listen to a couple of clips from Indian Ocean throughout the interview, and we'll start with this clip of Done, and then we'll get to our conversation with Frazee Ford on Basic Folk.
I was taking every hit from you, yeah. shooting son of a bitch, and I'm done. Oh, oh, I'm done. Who told you that you could rewrite the rules? And do you really take me for a goddamn fool? 'Cause I'm done.
Frazee Ford, welcome to Basic Folk. What a thrill.
Thanks for having me.
So you grew up in Canada with your dad, who I read was an activist wanted by the FBI. I don't know how true that is. And also your mom was called a free spirit who took you and your sister to Nepal, which sounds like a free spirit.
Very free, yeah.
You called them your hippie family. So for better or worse, how do you see each of your parents in yourself?
Well, first, let me clarify. My dad was wanted by the FBI, and they were on the run for a couple of years because he was a pretty serious activist in the 60s. But also to clarify, years later, I found out he wasn't my biological father. So it's like a whole thing.
Plot twist.
Many plot twists. How do I see each of my parents in myself? Is that the question?
Yes.
In so many ways. Firstly, my mom taught me how to sing as a very young person, like three. She wanted me to sing the melody so that she could harmonize. She grew up in Nebraska with a lot of this kind of Cajun, French, Irish sort of musical tradition. So many ways, my mom is like very wild. She's very fierce. She's probably the most adventurous person I've ever known in my life. Like, she took us traveling around Asia for 7 months backpacking when I was 10, and we were like climbing the Himalayas, and some of it was amazing, some of it was crazy, like all of the things. So I guess, yeah, my mom was like very independent and very self-motivated and very tough and very fun, you know. But
do you have similar singing voices?
Yes.
Cool.
I would say that so much of my style actually comes through her. I mean, I was more drawn eventually to learning kind of more sort of soul. I was always drawn to like blues and gospel and all that kind of soul stuff. And we sang a lot of like Emmylou Lou Harris and kind of country like stuff that she grew up singing. But her voice is very similar to mine. And like, it was just kind of a thing that was always around that wasn't really a big deal. Like, so yeah, I definitely like the musical tradition kind of comes straight through her.
That's cool.
Yeah, and then my dad was a poet and an artist and a general, like, outside-the-box thinker in so many ways. And, yeah, he kind of had that dedication to art and very, like, anti-capitalist and very questioning of sort of systems, but it wasn't, like, any kind of idealized childhood. It was, like, there's a lot of tough things that we all live through, but a lot of his, I was really given the permission to, like when I was young, he was like, just follow your heart, you know, and that kind of thing. It's sort of giving that permission to be an artist if that's what I wanted.
Right on. Like you were mentioning, the music that really struck you was soul music, even though you listened and were exposed to all sorts of music, but it was people like Otis Redding and Peebles, and from what I understand, especially Al Green, who you first heard when you were 11 years old. Do you recall what it was like when you first heard Al Green, and also like, what is that feeling like for you now when you hear Al Green, especially in thinking about reissuing Indian Ocean that you recorded with his band?
I heard Otis Redding when I was 11. It totally changed I just thought it was the most beautiful voice I'd ever heard in my life. I still feel that way. I didn't actually hear Al Green until I was like 19, and I was in London, and I was kind of in the middle of like a kind of a nervous breakdown. It was a whole part of my life.
Oh,
But
geez.
the first time I heard Al Green, it was Love and Happiness, and I was in the attic of a house in London with my friend Juliet, and it just like blew my mind. The layers, the expression, particularly like his voice, but also the organ. I thought about that music for so many years and listened. I had a cover band. I played Al Green. The way they worked together as a team, every single instrument just to me just embodied so much sort of spirituality and love and strength. And to this day, whenever I hear anything that those guys did, it's just, I don't know. It's everything that I've ever wanted out of music, like the way the arrangements are, the way they flow together, all the space that's given, but all the intuition that's used as well. And I still feel very insanely blessed that I got to meet those people and work with them, because they're still my heroes, like completely.
Amazing. I have so many questions about working with those guys on Indian Ocean. But what's interesting to note is that you love soul music. You mentioned that you had an Al Green cover band, but the sound that took off for you was folk and country with the Be Good Tanyas.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you work to incorporate your love of soul into that band, or how you see or saw a through line of country and soul?
Yeah, well, I was kind of always weaving back and forth between these sounds. Like, to me, it was a surprise when the Be Good Tanyas took off, because it was almost like this like nerdy study group that we had, because I was obsessed with like 30s gospel and blues. Sam was obsessed with 30s like country, and Trish was obsessed with these music. She was learning how to play the banjo, and I had grown up singing that kind of close harmony style. So meanwhile, like, Trish and I had a separate band that was kind of a little bit more like a soul band. And then I would sing with my mom all the time, or I would sing with friends. So I'd always have like a band, and then I'd have sort of a sit around the living room kind of like share song sound. And to me, the Be Good Tanyas was kind of that sit around the living room, like close to my heart, kind of private music that I would sing with my mom. And I just never really thought of it as stage music. It's weird, but I just never really thought of it that way. But I think that, like, you know, and I was thinking about this also too, like the Buena Vista Social Club, like those kind of bands, like, because I started out in these bands and there was always like, you know, it was the 90s. So it was like, there'd always be some guitar player. It was all about being loud. And so I was forever seeking the subtlety of arrangements that could happen in an acoustic setting, but also bring that to like a band setting. And so all that kind of like thought and sensitivity that goes into an Al Green arrangement or like a Buena Vista Social Club, we were bringing that, those concepts into the Be Good Tanyas. And I think that we sort of artificially separate country from soul and folk, and they're not that far apart. So, you know, it's just a little bit different instrumentation, and then you're moving over to soul versus kind of a country sound. And there was always, like, if you listen back to those albums, a lot of those songs with slightly different instrumentation could be soul songs. It's just that we were, you know, those kind of close harmonies really push it to that kind of more almost like bluegrass sound. So it was like, for me, it was a bit of an artificial separation, but because I loved all of these music so much, I was always trying to figure out how to knit them together in some way. That was like constantly sort of an obsession that I had.
Yeah, their Be Good Tanyas definitely have a groove to them that I feel like has kind of like laid the foundation for anybody who wants to have a trio of close harmony singers together. Now, when you say, like, I want to know how it felt, like, with the Be Good Tanyas, like, you're saying that, like, the Be Good Tanyas were quiet in a time where it was the 90s, so everybody was being loud. And, like, the music that you were singing with your mom was kind of like a private type of music. So, like, how did it feel to take that quiet private music and perform it so publicly?
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, I think that because I grew up with my mom singing all the time, and it was really just like furniture around the house, it wasn't like it wasn't a big deal. It was just part of life. And so it was always kind of surprising to me how much people responded to that music. Because it, to me, was just sort of a very natural extension of kind of my family. And I guess in a way I had it in my mind that there was like entertainment music and there was sort of, you know, just kind of natural music almost. I don't know. It's kind of funny. So it's almost like it isn't till more recently that I've been able to look back and be like, oh yeah, I get why people were have been so into that sound, you know, but like,
yeah.
At the time it was sort of like, I was like, yeah, we're just singing together. Like, that's what we're doing. You know, I didn't think too much about it. Like, it was just sort of like, oh, I guess people like this, like, quiet. Because, you know, at the time, it was like these big voiced people were like huge. Like, you got to be like hitting these huge notes. And I was so obsessed with like these soul singers that I was kind of like, oh, I want to be able to sing all this kind of soul stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was just sort of took for granted that kind of like natural country sound that I grew up with or something.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so Indian Ocean was first released in 2014. We're getting a deluxe edition. There is a famous story that the documentary filmmaker Robert Gordon heard you on the radio and invited you to work with the High Rhythm Section, aka Al Green's band. The song that he heard on the radio was If You Gonna Go, which is from your first solo record, which is a folky record, but definitely has some soul elements in it. How surprised were you that he heard your love of soul music in that song, and how validating was it to get that call?
That was one of the strangest experiences of my life. I also just feel like I don't think I was being played on the radio in Memphis very often. And he heard the song while he was like getting a tire changed. And he didn't hear who it was. So he phoned the radio station to find out who it was. And then he looked me up and sent me this email. And I was so like floored. And it was such a dream come true that I didn't reply for like 2 months. Like I just couldn't even fit it into my mind what had happened. It still is like such a crazy coincidence. Sorry, what was the rest of the question?
Just how surprised you were. It sounds like you were really surprised.
I was shocked.
Yeah.
But when we did Obadiah, that record, John Ram, who I make my records with at Afterlife Studios, we had sat down and talked about the production of that album. And because it was my first kind of solo record separate from the Bigatanias, we talked about, you know, what direction we wanted to take it. And so we were like, let's do something that is somewhere between Al Green, I'm Still in Love with You production and Harvest, Neil Young Harvest. And so we intentionally were lifting everything we could from Al, you know, from the Willie Mitchell high record sound in like a quiet, subtle way. So he, the fact that he got it and recognized the influence, because I was also extremely obsessed with Ann Peebles, was just, it still blows my mind that he just like nailed it and then was like, oh, you could work with these guys. And I was just like, what the hell? What the hell?
So of the opportunity to work with the High Rhythm Section, you said, I was actually terrified because it was a dream come true, that I almost didn't like the idea of bringing the dream into reality. It just seems safer to keep it in the dream world. And also, it sounds like you didn't respond to him for quite a while, but you eventually did and you went for it. So like, what did this experience teach you about going for things that scare you?
Yeah, I was terrified. I mean, it was like, I was obsessed with literally every single note that those guys played, and I knew it. And every single person in my band, because we also brought some band members, they were also like worshipped at the church of those musicians. And so it was terrifying. I felt really scared. But they were so kind and so welcoming. And I think that, like, I remember going for a run like a week before I went to Memphis for the first time, because these sessions were kind of broken up between a few years. And just that I had so much anxiety about it. And I still to this day think about how anxious I felt going into this experience, and that type of anxiety is such a sort of key point about, like, if you're feeling that kind of fear, it is probably a good idea to move toward it. That really important big things are often feel really uncomfortable, and that's just really important. And I continue to feel extremely uncomfortable doing a lot of things. Like, comfort isn't a marker of whether you should do something or not.
It's so cool to be able to like identify that type of like healthy anxiety. And also, speaking of nerves, I heard that when you got down to Memphis, which was very soon after you like made the decision to go, you did not have many songs written. So were you at all nervous about that? Like, what was it like to go down there and not have like all the songs ready to go?
Yeah, no, I didn't have very many songs at all. I had a few songs, and it was just kind of almost like the beginning of an exploration. Like, how was this going to go? It felt really scary. It felt very raw. I'm still like that. Like, I'll go into the studio and kind of not know what I'm going to do, and it still feels scary.
How
Like,
free-spirited of you.
I just kind of like, sometimes I really feel like every album I learn over and over that this piece of work has it's like you're a conduit for it, but it has its own intelligence. It's just kind of using you, and you feel so lost and like human and confused, but the thing itself has sort of an energy and an entity, and by the end it'll kind of come together like these puzzle pieces, which doesn't make it any easier in the process at all, but it like often, like, you'll get these foreshadowings, and if you're kind of like following your intuition, it will lead you in a direction. And I guess I kind of sensed that, but it was scary. I mean, there I was, like,
Did you have that knowledge that you just shared back then, where you're like, this is all gonna work, it's gonna all work out?
no. I mean, I think, you know, you have your different selves. Like, some part of me knew that that was going to work out. Some part of me knew exactly what to try, but it's not like the rest of me is just a regular bumbling human with like a million thoughts in my head that's like so full of self-doubt. And so there's always that part's always at the front, and like the wise part of me is generally at the back. And you know, like one of my close friends is always like, when you start talking about a different career that you need to go to do, because all this is too crazy, that's when I know your album's almost done. And I'm like, okay, I'm glad you know that, because I'm always pretty convinced that like I don't know what I'm doing at all. So it's like that. But yeah, we did that kind of exploratory session, and yeah, and then I kind of went home and like had writer's block for a while, and just thought about it for a long time. Like, what was I going to do? Because I didn't want to make like a soul record. I wanted to do like a real collaboration. Yeah. And also, I think that they were like, oh, this person's, you know, maybe they're like, oh, she's coming down, she just wants that Al Green sound. And once they figured out that I really wanted to like collaborate with them and create something new, they showed up early, and they were like so excited about this whole project, and they were so sweet and so lovely.
What was that like when they realized, like, oh, Frazee actually wants us in on this, like 100%. What was that like for you to have one of your favorite bands suddenly, like, fully invested in your songs?
It was amazing. Like, I have a clip actually of Teenie showing up like the second day, and he's dressed all in turquoise in a turquoise car with like all this turquoise everything, and he's like sitting in his car blasting Fleetwood Mac, and he's like kind of like Fleetwood Mac, like it's so awesome, or what, I can't remember what he said. But they started to really open up to me, Because I think that I was showing them a lot of vulnerability. And I think the music that I was bringing was pretty like close to my heart. And I think that they just started to sense that like this was a real, like honest kind of collaboration. And they just were so open. And they said that they'd always wanted to like collaborate with a folk artist. It's something that they hadn't really had the chance to do. So I got to know them really as people and still feel close to them. Like they're so lovely.
Okay. A million more questions about this. you've spoken of the band's relationship to groove and space. So how did working with them on Indian Ocean expand your relationship to groove and space?
Yeah, so many ways. I mean, they're an entity. It's the like this power of people who've played together for like 40, 50 years. And they are brothers. And they have just been this powerhouse behind so many artists in that space, in at Stax as well, with Willie Mitchell. And they're just almost this like organic force. But they are also so respectful and they move as one, but they take so many risks. Like they use all their intuition that they've had working together for so long and just move in all these kind of really unexpected directions. And I really thought about it when I was there. I was like, like Soul was always this like experimental risk-taking thing. It was never frozen in time as any one style. It was always just about these like experiments and risks that everyone was taking together musically. And I think like because I came out of like what I was saying before, all this kind of acoustic music and really wanting to preserve that like space and subtlety, that I was pretty like pulled back in my sound because I wanted the vocals to be forward. I wanted the emotion to be first. I didn't want to be dominated by these kind of like these loud sort of sounds. But I think with them, I learned to let go and just kind of trust what they were doing and trust where they were taking things. Because what I realized is like, they really responded so emotionally to almost like to anything that I did. And they would take it in these directions that I wasn't expecting at all. And it allowed me to kind of sit back and be like, okay, where are these guys going to take it without feeling like I had to, like sometimes I would guide, but sometimes I would just be like, where, like when I recorded September Feels, it was in the first session. It was when I was in the most nervous. I was so nervous. I actually had them turned down in my headphones because I was just sort of overwhelmed by the experience. And then that song originally was kind of this high, lonesome kind of country song. And then when I came out into the control room, they had done this whole thing around it that was so like love and happiness. And it felt like just the quintessential, like that's their power. That's like their free, joyous expression that just like brought so much life to that song.
Can you talk about the moment or like after you were able to, when you were recording with them, like turn them up in your headphones and like not be overwhelmed, but actually like be in it with them?
Yeah, I think that I just like, after that song, I was like, okay, I'm safe. I can concentrate. I can listen. And, you know, and sometimes they got it immediately. And sometimes I would bring in my own bass player or my own drummer to kind of guide it because we were really trying to meet in the middle. And, you know, sometimes their instincts were incredibly perfect right away. And sometimes it was like we were kind of carving it out and being like, okay, what does this song need? But just they were so, and even like, because then I went away and I worked on these songs for a long time and I had writer's block and I was kind of like, oh, what am I trying to write for this album? And then eventually I realized it really doesn't matter what I write. I can write anything and I can bring it to them and I can trust that what they're going to do is listen very much with their hearts and respond so intuitively. And it just, like, soul music is just feeling and the responsiveness. And even looking back on this footage we have that we never really looked at, I'm just like watching their faces and how much they're like feeling what I'm doing and how much I'm feeling what they're doing. Like, it's just kind of this mutual, like, reverence for truth and for pain and for joy, like, that we, like, we really met there, you know?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've been in an experience like this again, but you're somebody who is used to collaborating with close friends. So how did this experience of working with people who didn't know you helped build your confidence in yourself as a leader, like in unknown situations in the studio or other types of like musical unknowns?
Yeah, I think like I don't do that very often. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think it really affected how I work with my band, and that in a lot of ways I learned to just kind of to let go a lot more. Like, I think in the early days of Big Times, it's almost like we were fighting to carve out some space for sort of what we wanted to hear. And it was a bit of a fight. Like, we'd invite someone in to play and they would just like play really loud, or, you know, we'd be looking for a drummer. And it was like all about this kind of male dominated thing. And so, like, I was in all these bands where it's like the bands would play too loud. And so I think I was like really protective of that space of like subtlety. But I think after that experience, kind of as a band leader in that way, I understood that most of the people that I work with are really like, it allowed me to kind of let go and lean on trust my band more and trust musicians more, to see what they have to say, and let them take up a lot more space, essentially.
So sadly, Teeny actually passed away in between the time, I feel like my timeline, let me know if my timeline is wrong. He died in between the time that you finished the sessions and the album release back in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
How did his death impact the way you feel about your work and your time with him?
So it was quite a while between the sessions that we, like, I can't remember what year it was, but we went down. And then it was like at least 2 years before I went back and finished the album. And he was calling me pretty regularly to just like check in. And, you know, he was just like, so I really felt like in a certain way, he waited for me to come back and finish that album. Because the first time I went, he was like, by the second time I went, he was on oxygen and his health was failing pretty quickly. And I think he was unwell for quite a while. And he passed away like just over a month after we finished that last session. Wow. And I really did feel like he kind of held on to finish that record. And I felt so honored by that. And I always felt his presence around me, and I still do. Like, the amount of brilliance he has, his genius. And I felt like, I still just feel so lucky that I got to have that experience with him at the end of his life. And he was so funny. It's so wacky. And I recorded him telling so many stories, and they just like, I have SIP older brothers, and they just really treated me like a little sister, and it was very special.
Mm. You mentioned this earlier that Teeny had told you that the band had always wanted to record with a folk musician.
Yeah.
So folk music is all about telling a story, and soul is often about the pure emotion and the rhythm. So what was their approach like in terms of supporting the stories found in your songs?
Yeah, I think for them it was more, yeah, just like similarly, because the story is the feeling. It's the same thing. There's maybe a little different descriptives, but I think they really respond emotionally. I mean, at one point I was like a little nervous about the song Done, because I always thought maybe it was like a little negative or something. And Charles, who's the keyboard player, was like, he was like, you know, he loved it, but he was like, as long as you're okay, like as long as you're not holding on to this thing, because that's, you know, he had some like spiritual, he's a reverend. So he was like having his opinion about like not wanting me to stay angry. And, but it, I felt like it was the same. Like I felt like they responded with the feeling regardless. Mm.
So the writing on the record is filled with some fraught, pretty confessional songs like Done, What a Banger. How do you attribute the way you were writing to the collaboration with the brothers, if at all?
Yeah, I think that the idea of the collaboration shut me down for a little while, because I was I had it in my head that I was writing for this soul record. And it wasn't until I really let that idea go and just wrote the way that I write that I felt free to express myself. And I just felt like the songs that came out at that time were the songs that came out. I was doing a lot of therapy. There was a lot of sort of stuff from my past that I'd been processing for a lot of years. And in a lot of ways, this album was sort of a result of many years of sort of like healing work that I'd done around my childhood and my family. And that was sort of a very vulnerable thing to kind of bring to these guys. But that's when I settled and sort of realized like it didn't matter what I was going to sing about, that they were just there to support this emotional movement. That's when it really started to flow.
Mm. Even though the songs are heavy, the brothers brought a lot of joy to the recordings. And you said, I learned from them about the power of marrying hardness and joy together. Those sessions were really a spiritual lesson as well. So what would you say is like the key to bringing together great sorrow and great joy? And then after that realization, how did that change you as an artist?
I think that within that African-American tradition of so many of their musical forms, it's not just this sort of nihilistic, you know, if they're going to sing something sad, something hard, it's never going to be from this place of just the pain. It's always going to be with an attempt to overcome and to turn that pain into like, into spiritual evolution, into power, into joy. And I really felt like when I played a song, like I hadn't listened to the song for a long time, but season after season, or they just, there's always this undertone of bringing the joy to it, and that there'd be no reason to just like leave a listener or leave yourself hanging in a place of just pure darkness, that there's this underlying, that's what music is. Music is a healing energy, and that healing energy comes through with that marriage of like depth of difficulty and depth of joy within it. And they just were so masterful at always kind of finding a way to kind of elevate something from beneath rather than just have it be like a stark sort of sadness. Like taking that stark sadness and bringing these like elements of like bubbling, like, you know, the organ is just like the way Charles plays. It's like this, you're floating on these clouds. Like no matter what he plays, it's just, there's this lifting sort of energy. So that really changed my ideas about, like what music is essentially.
Mm. I love the story of you and the band trying to play I'm Still in Love with You, where you learned about their 40-year argument. How did that interesting tension change the atmosphere in the studio?
That was so funny because, like, at the end of the day, they're also brothers, you know? So they have these, like, old-standing human foibles and, like, I say, okay, so Boo Mitchell, who's Willie Mitchell's grandson, runs the studio. And like, you know, we start in on that song and suddenly they're like shouting at each other. They leave the recording session. They're all pissed off and they're basically behaving like they're having like they're children and they're having a fight. And it was so funny and so human. And then there's a video clip somewhere that Robert Gordon filmed so many of these sessions. And so we didn't know what to do. They'd all left. And Boo was like, they've been fighting over that one chord for 40 years. Like, never try to play that song. and then we were like, okay, like, noted. And then so I sit down at the piano and I start playing out Weather Pattern. Like, I start working out on, or was that it? Yeah, I think it's Weather Pattern or something. And then there's just a hilarious scene where one by one, they come in and they're all kind of mad at each other. But then they're all like sitting, like standing around me, like learning the song. And like a bunch of little kids who've just had, you know, they're fighting over some toy and somebody got mad. It was just like so human and so hilarious.
Oh my gosh. I love that. All right. I've got a couple questions about your other creative outlets. Here, let me list them. Sewing, painting, ceramics, making lamps, pattern drafting, to mention a few. And you say music as a creative outlet has more pressure by being public, so I like to reclaim my creativity and lose the sense of an audience for a while, which is so smart. It seems like you have so many other skills and also the skill of being able to pick up other creative outlets. How do you go about approaching a new creative skill and how do you feel that impacting your musicality?
I really just let myself be curious about whatever. I'm a curious person and I like to do something with my hands. I like to sculpt. I like to paint. I like to just do literally anything. I get like, I have to stop myself from like making all my furniture or whatever. Like it's just, I want to understand how everything works, how every craft works. It just keeps my brain good. Like if I'm like down a YouTube tunnel trying to figure out how to like I just bought a kiln and I'm trying to learn how to make mix glazes, and it keeps me sane. It keeps me, because I can't write music all the time. I'm not somebody who just like writes music all the time. I don't even like I think because as Bigotanias we sort of experienced like fame at like a bunch of years ago, and it was hard and it was weird. And I didn't like having my whole identity be one thing as a musician. I didn't even like, I feel like any of these identifiers, like I'm a this, I'm a that, kind of gets in the way of just like having fun and just, or for me, it did anyway, kind of like if you get too wrapped up in the idea of yourself as any one thing, it's kind of limiting. So it's sort of, I don't know. I just let myself explore and I'll just get obsessed with a new thing and I'll let myself kind of just go for it. And I feel like when I dive in, I'll feel myself be pulled toward visual art, or I'll be pulled toward writing, or I'll be pulled toward anything. I feel like everybody is so creative, actually. Like that's, you know, as human beings, like we are such a disaster. But what we have, what we really have, is that we're all extremely creative. Like every single one of us is naturally incredibly creative. Like it's, the downside is that we're creatively self-destructive and we're creatively stupid in so many ways. But really, like, I think humans harnessing their creativity is like it's such an untapped potential in all of us, I think. And all creative forms relate to all creative forms. So anything that you learn in one area, you can transfer that to another area, because it's all just taking risks. It's using your intuition. It's making decisions. That's all it is. And the less good you are at something, the more you have to sort of learn about yourself by trying that thing. So it's all, what I find is like, I can get stuck in music because I also have a side that's like really perfectionistic. And that's like your biggest enemy when you're trying to do something. So for me to switch into making clothes or ceramics, then I'm just like, I don't care if I make a mistake. I just try. And those kind of risks and mistakes you made are the thing that's going to be like, that's the only way to make anything, is to be willing to be bad at something. So that always helps me when I come back to music, to just remember the thrill of just being willing to like totally fuck something up.
Do you have an Etsy store?
No, I do not, but I've been thinking about like selling some stuff just to get it out of my house.
Right. So I have always thought that you have had like an incredible sense of fashion.
Oh, thank
you.
And
as we talked about, you design and sew some of your own clothing.
Yeah.
What is like your fashion ethos? Like, what are you thinking about when you design your own clothes?
Well, for one, I have like a different body type. I'm curvier, I'm bigger. So I like to just, it's harder for me to find stuff that works for me, that's in my size. So that's one of the reasons I make my own clothes. What is my fashion ethos? I think it's like, it's funny because my son is now really into fashion and we talk fashion like really intensely. Like he'll be getting up in the morning and he'll wake me up to like review his look. Like it's kind of intense. And my friend who was sleeping over was like, what the hell is going on? Like we're discussing the philosophy of like his jewelry or whatever. But I think that like fashion is just another way to like express yourself. So it's like, if I'm getting dressed in the morning, it's like the first creative act of the day where you're like, how do I feel? Like, what color am I drawn to? What's the energy? And so it's the same thing. I always find it interesting that like one day you're really drawn to like peach and the next day you're really like, it's like this conversation with your soul. Like your soul is like really drawn to a very specific thing sometimes. And I'm always like, what is that energy? What is that? It's like we're, you know, like a flower or something in nature, like your being is drawn to like express itself in some very specific way. And like, who am I to argue with that? You know, like that's kind of my philosophy, is like just aligning yourself with an energy that feels right for you. And I feel like when people do that, when they express themselves genuinely, it gives other people permission. And then when you see them on the street, you're seeing something really authentic about them. And it's so beautiful to see, like when people are so, even if their thing that they want to express is that they just want to wear like their grandpa's coveralls or something, like it's not expensive. It's not fancy. It's just like, what particular thing are you in particular feeling that moment? Even if it's like you wear a white t-shirt every day, that's what you're feeling. That's your, so expression, I guess, is my philosophy.
Great. Love it. Okay. Before I let you go, let's do the lightning round.
Okay.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's start with, who is your fashion icon?
Ooh, who is my fashion icon? God. I mean, I do really love Paloma El Seltzer. She's great. I don't know if I have a fashion icon. Right now, my fashion icon is my son, because he's just like killing it. He's got some great looks going on. My Caroline Ballhorn, who sings with me in my band, she's got insane style. Like, I have so many people whose style I love.
Amazing. What is your favorite type of venue to perform at?
My favorite type of venue is like kind of a mid-sized theater, like the Vogue Theater in Vancouver. That's maybe a 1500 historical theater with a dance floor. So there's some seating, but there's also dancing, and there's really nice acoustics. Like, that's my favorite kind of space to play in.
Okay. Most likely haunted.
Yeah, definitely haunted. And I like to, you know, if there's a few ghosts I can hang with, I like that too.
Love. What are you drinking before the show?
I generally have a little bit of red wine.
Who is your celebrity crush?
Ooh, celebrity crush. Oh God, I'm so bad with those types of things. Right now, I'm really, you know, who's living on this? Do you know Bobby Manuez? They are an actor, and I run into them on the island that I'm living on. Muñez, Bobby Muñez, and Julianne Moore. Love her.
The best. She's been doing some weird things lately.
So good. Also, I'm loving just like watching older actresses be older actresses. It's so refreshing.
Yeah. All right, here's one. Which musician, living or dead, would you like to design a stage outfit for?
Design a stage outfit for D'Angelo.
Ah,
I
nice.
mean,
That's a really
and of
good
course,
answer.
sing with him, but like design a stage outfit, yes.
Yeah. Let's do the combo. Dream collab, dream design. Okay, this is the last one. Where is the most beautiful place in the world?
I was just there. I live part-time on a small Gulf island, and I went to this walk today right on this cliff, and you can see all the mountains and the ocean, and it's like these trees and that's the most beautiful place, I think.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Great. Brazy, thank you so much. This was so fun to talk to you. I
So
loved it.
fun. Thank you.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of BGS. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out on folkalley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can go to our website, basicfolk.com, or you can listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, perhaps you should share it with a friend, like maybe your friend Rachel, who you think of all the time when you're like thinking about the Bigatanias, because you like mentioned one day that you were listening to the Bigatanias and she surprised you by saying, "Oh my God, I love the Bigatanias." It just like is kind of mind-blowing how far of a reach that band has. So maybe Rachel would appreciate this episode of Basic Folk. So send it to her. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Bye.